One species that's not on the endangered list is grizzly bears, but their habitats are shrinking. And 40 years ago, one man emerged as a kind of savior of grizzlies. His name is Doug Peacock, and in wilderness circles, he's a legend. He's a Vietnam vet who was so traumatized by the war that when he got back home, he couldn't handle daily life. So he escaped into the wilderness. And when he was camping out in Yellowstone, he had his first brush with a grizzly. It changed his life. In fact, over the past decades, grizzlies have become so deeply embedded into Peacock's life that he even dreams about them.
One of my types of dreams is there's a mother grizzly out there, and she's got a bear cub, but the other cub is my daughter, crawling along on all fours. But I'm worried about my daughter. Sometimes my grizzlies are not quite natural. They're just distorted just a bit, and they can take on the specter of legend and of fear. You know, the bear and I, we have a relationship. We're not talking, but, you know, I know when it's dangerous and when it's not dangerous.
Doug Peacock's a natural history buff, and he's puzzled over one of the great mysteries in the history of extinction. Why did the giant mammals that once roamed North America disappear some 10,000 years ago? We're talking about huge lions and mammoths, the saber-toothed tiger, and most fearsome of all, he told Steve Paulson, the giant short-faced bear.
This is an animal that averaged well over a ton. The bigger specimens measure 7 feet at the hip. Standing up, it would have been a 15-foot bear. And this bear is a pure carnivore.
You're talking about a bear that's twice as big as the grizzly of today.
Easily twice as big as grizzlies today. And that basically precluded humans hunting big game. Now, anybody coming out of the Arctic, you know, 30 or 15,000 years ago, would have been a big game hunter. It's the only way you can survive an Arctic winter. But as they went south and they ran into especially the short-faced bear, they couldn't secure a kill. But the short-faced bear had a lot of company. We had lions on this continent that were the same genus as the African lion, but twice as big. Also, we had saber-tooths. We had an American cheetah that's twice as big as the African one.
You know, one thing that seems to have happened is once these ancient ancestors, these old humans, invented the Clovis spear point, everything changed. I mean, it was the revolutionary technology where suddenly they could bring down a mammoth, and they were dangerous at that point.
That's true. It's, you know, the first of a long line of iconic American inventions. You know, it was the fluted, deadly 6-inch Clovis spear point, you know, as beautiful and sleek as a Patriot missile. We know nothing of these people except their material culture, pretty much. They seem to show up everywhere. Within 100 years, you find this iconic mammoth hunting projectile point from New York to Panama, from Washington State to Florida. And within a period of 300 years, the Clovis people and the animals they hunted, the great megafauna of the late Pleistocene, went extinct and were gone.
And that's one of the greatest mysteries in human history.
Truly,
is. In this relatively short period, all of these huge beasts that you were describing, they were all gone in a fairly short period of time. And that time seemed to correspond to when the Clovis people were around.
That's exactly true. And at the same time, we had our global warming that started about 14.7 thousand years ago. And that, no doubt, started to fragment habitats. You know?
Well, I mean, you're raising two possibilities as to what may have caused all of these huge animals to go extinct. It was global warming at that point, you know, the earlier version of global warming, or maybe these ancient humans hunted them into extinction.
I don't think either one quite stands up by itself. Human beings certainly didn't kill off all of those animals when Clovis showed up, because those animals were on the decline and moving around a lot, 14,000 years ago. The habitat is being fragmented, but it really very much looks like the coup de grace was hunting by humans and probably the Clovis hunters.
Doug, I know one of the reasons why you're so fascinated by this history is you have been for decades kind of entranced by what it's like to live alongside a top predator. I mean, for you, it's been the grizzly bear. You've lived among them for decades now. And you have said that the psychic landscape changes once you are in their presence. Once you're in the presence of an animal that could easily kill you if it so chose to.
It does transform the psychic landscape like nothing else can. You know, you take your Kelpie pack and you hike in the High Sierras or anywhere in Colorado, and you're top dog, you walked on the trail, and you can be thinking about your girlfriend or your portfolio or something else, but, you know, you added a grizzly bear to that equation, and all of a sudden you're in grizzly country, you're not the top of the food chain, and you necessarily start looking around, and you smell better, you hear better. And, you know, I don't use trails. I've been chasing grizzlies now, well, it's 45 years or a little more. And I also fight to protect them, too, because in a way they saved my life when I came back from Vietnam, because what I needed after two tours as a Green Beret medic in Vietnam was to get out of myself. You know, the last thing I needed was self-indulgence. And when you enter grizzly country, where you're living with an animal that if it chooses could kill and eat you anytime it wants to, self-indulgence is just utterly impossible.
Well, and to put this in context, you just come back from Vietnam. You were a Green Beret medic. You were pretty shattered, weren't you, by what you saw?
I was there through the Tet Offensive, and the short story is I was responsible for, handled, and saw too many dead children. It was too much at the end. You know, I had gone sort of native by then in Vietnam, and the command knew it. They ordered me out of the field, choppered me out. I was way up in the Central Highlands in Quang Nai Province. We flew out to the coast. On my last day in the field in Vietnam, we got shot at, which is no big deal. You get shot at in a helicopter all the time. But I looked at the map, and I said, oh, yeah, I know this place. I've been on the ground there. It was My Lai.
But you flew over during the My Lai Massacre?
Well, it was happening March 16th, the morning of March 16th, 1968. A year later, I saw those pictures in Life magazine. Those pictures changed my life forever. You know, I was never going to be a candidate for reentering society, and I haven't yet.
So you landed back in America. You landed out in the woods,
in the
wilderness.
I camped out for several years, literally, truly.
Why was that so healing for you, that experience?
Basically, it was because of the grizzlies. I couldn't be around people. The one place I've always been comfortable in my life is in wilderness. You know, I was raised that way. And so, you know, I found myself camping out in the Rocky Mountains. And so one day I'm in this little tiny hot creek, which isn't very big. But here I am soaking in this hot spring in Yellowstone after the war. I look off to the side. Across the meadow, about 200 feet away, was a mother grizzly and two yearlings. I didn't know anything about grizzlies then, except you weren't supposed to be around mothers with cubs. So I decided I was going to climb a tree. So she turned, and I stood up. And, you know, the whirlpool-like effect on my brain, all the hot water caused me to black out. But I was terrified, and so I grabbed this tree head on, bashed it with my head, cut a huge gash in my forehead. Blood's pouring down my eyes, but I'm still so scared. I climb up to the top of this lodgepole pine tree, and it's cold. It's 40 degrees, and it's October, and the wind is blowing like hell. And I get to the top of this tree, and I find out that it's not much bigger than a Christmas tree. So anyway, this mother grizzly and her two yearling, they graze in the area for 40 minutes. They come within 20 feet of me. They never look up. They know I'm there. They just ignore me. And I'm sitting up there like some kind of silly bird, you know, blue from cold, bleeding. Those bears got my attention. They got my attention.
They did more than that. They changed your life, it sounds like.
Well, they did. They did because I'm a critic of our society. And that's what I think a writer has to be. And I inherited that from my old friend and mentor, Edward Abbey. And, you know, the easiest exit from culture is wilderness. You go up in wilderness, and after 3 or 4 days, something happens, and you're free of culture. And you're able to look back upon your own kind and your own ways with an objective mind, you know, that's free of judgment. You know, you add a grizzly bear to that occasion, and that's what allowed me to, you know, regather the elements of my own humanity. You know, those grizzly bears saved my life. I wouldn't have had children if I hadn't been, you know, humanized in a bit by having to watch the great grizzly. And the great lessons of grizzly bears are actually lessons of tolerance, lessons of restraint, and above all, in its enforced humility.
Grizzlies are also pretty dangerous. I mean, did you have any close encounters?
Oh, yeah. I've been charged over 30 times, almost always mothers with cubs. It was always my fault. During the day when it's hot, grizzlies sleep on daybeds, and they really sack out. So you can get closer than you want to be to a mother grizzly. And in the early days, I wasn't quite as astute at discerning where these daybeds were going to be, and I got too close a number of times. When a grizzly's charging me, I turn my head off to the side, because that's what bears do to one another. And I hold my arms out, and I'll talk gently. I don't think it matters what you say so much as how you say it. And I don't move a muscle. And one of those mother grizzlies charged all the way, and about 6 feet away, skidded on her heels. She came so close to me, she leaned forward and sniffed my pant leg. And then after about 3 seconds, maybe four, it seemed like an eternity, but it wasn't very long, she just turned around, spun, and ran off, you know. So that's happened. It's happened a lot of times to me. And
were you terrified?
Not during those moments. A fear of bears is healthy. But I have bear dreams all the time. And my guess is that I work out my fear of grizzlies in my dreams. And when I'm out in the ground, fear doesn't happen to me. You know, I understand bears. I have relationships with a few individual grizzlies. There are dangerous bears, and I'm very careful around them. You really got to pay attention.
That's Doug Peacock talking with Steve Paulson. He's the author of Grizzly Years and In the Shadow of the Sabretooth. He was the inspiration for the character Hayduk in Edward Abbey's eco-classic, The Monkey Wrench Gang. You can hear him talk about their friendship and about the grizzly he calls his Moby Dick Bear in the Uncut interview, which you can find on our website at ttbook.org.